everyone. Before we start, I wanted to let you know, if you would like to watch our whole service, head to our website. That's dc2.me. And from the media drop-down, click sermons. You can watch our whole service there. And now, here's this week's sermon.
Well, good morning, Discovery. My name is Zach. I'm one of the pastors here. And our teaching today is rooted in John chapter 1, starting in verse 1. And it says this: In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. What has come into being in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness did not overcome it. But to all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave power to become children of God, who were born not of blood, or of the will of the flesh, or of the will of man, but of God. And the Word became flesh and lived among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. Welcome to Discovery Church. We are in the second week in a series that we're calling The Essentials. And this really was a series that came up with the idea, coming from the place of, when we say Christian, what do we mean by that? What are the things that we would rally around and say, yeah, that's what we believe, but it's not just another thing. That's like essential to what we believe. And some of this from our church tradition, Discovery Church comes out of the Restoration Movement. One of our favorite slogans in the Restoration Movement is, in the essentials, unity, in the non-essentials, liberty, and in all things, charity. So when we say essential, what do we mean by that? And this is actually a question that the church has been asking since the church began. And the way that they would write these kind of things down, they'd call them a creed, which sounds like very, you know, formal, or like a 90s rock band, however, you know, you've grown up. But a creed is really, it's just trying to define something. It's almost like ripping a page out of a dictionary. And for a creed, they're just saying, when you define Christian, what are you saying? And today we find ourselves honing in on the second paragraph of this creed that we find that was written by some folks. This is one of the earliest creeds that you just heard. It's called the Nicene Creed. But as this group of people was trying to define Christian, what's like essential? What's not peripheral? What's not things we can argue about that don't really matter? Like, what matters? Today we strike this conversation about Jesus. Who's Jesus? Does Jesus matter? And what about him matters? And if you would just take literal lines from this creed, here would be this particular page out of the dictionary that you'd rip out. Jesus, he's got some nouns attached to him. He's Lord. He's the only Son, a begotten Son, eternally begotten Son, God from God, which is not to say that it's not the same as true God from true God. Those are very distinct phrases in this creed. Some nouns. But there's also some verbs that this creed is going to say about Jesus as it's trying to define what's essential. Through him, everything was made. Through him, salvation comes. And it was by the power of the Holy Spirit that he became incarnate in flesh. What do you believe about Jesus? There's actually a question that he asked his followers. Matthew 16, he turns to his friend Peter and says, who do you say that I am? It's a really difficult question. We mentioned this last week. For those of you that have grown up around or near church, it's kind of one of those questions that pops up like an agreement to a new iPhone download, where it's just like, just scroll to the bottom and hit agree. Like, Nicene Creed, fine, I agree. But what do you think about him? Because it really matters. And as a framework for our teaching today, I wanted to share a story with you about when I was in eighth grade. One of my friends, I'm going to call him Jer just to protect his identity, but Monday morning, I roll into school, and it's very clear that Jer's not okay, but I don't get a chance to connect with him. What I do get a chance to hear is some other friends who approach me and say, did you hear what happened at Jer's house this weekend? I had no idea. And it took a while. It actually wasn't until lunch that I could sit with them. I was waiting at our table, you know, where my dudes sat, and Jared didn't come sit with us. And I was like, that's so weird. So I went on a little mission and found him. He was like totally cooped up, like fetal position in the corner of the school type of thing. Sit down, and I'm like, hey man, you doing okay? And he's like, I don't want to talk about it. I'm like, okay. I just sit here with you? He was like, sure. So I just sit down. And as it turns out, Jer's a verbal processor. So that's kind of fun for me because it's about 30 seconds of silence and then just, bleh, here's all this stuff that's going. So here's the story. Jer's parents were going out of town the weekend before. And like classic Hollywood, we make movies about that kind of thing. He was like, this is a chance I can like have some friends over. And it just so happens that the friends that Jer invited were very invitational friends. I mean, they're very cool that way. But the handful, four or five friends that he was like, hey, come over, we can just hang with no parents around, turned into 30 middle school and some high school kids that were all over at his house ransacking different pantries with different things in them, as you might assume. And classic Hollywood style, it just so turns out that Jer's parents came home early from the trip that they were on and walk into the house and see everything that's going on. Fast forward to Monday morning, Jer's not doing so good. Which as he's telling the story, we're about halfway through and I'm like, how come I didn't get invited to this party? And then we get to the end of the story and here's the punishment that I got. I'm like, hey, thanks so much for not inviting me to this party. That's crazy. But you can't invite somebody to a party at a place that you don't belong. Like it's messed up. You can't do it that way. If you're gonna host something, it has to be your house. And in Jer's case, it was his house, but it wasn't his house. He had no right to do what he did. You can't decide, I'm going to throw a party at my neighbor's house and just waltz in on a Saturday afternoon and say, hey, today's the day. I need you to clear out. Like, it has to be yours. And so as we're thinking about who is Jesus, I want us to begin thinking through where's he from and what's his. Because he only has a right to invite us to the place where he's from, and he only has a right to invite us to relationship with who he really is. So what are those things, and how do we hold that? You might be like, what are you talking about? We're going to get there. This creed, this Nicene Creed that was written, as they were trying to define, what does it mean when we say Christian? Really, this creed, this group of people, it was a council. They met in a city called Nicaea. That's why it's called the Nicene Creed, northern Turkey. An ecumenical gathering, not just one denomination of church, but church leaders from all over the known world at the time. And they were really coming to discuss one guy's idea, and his name is Arius. And Arius had this idea that Jesus couldn't have been God. Because Jesus was created, and if he was created, then he wasn't with God in the beginning, and therefore he couldn't know God like that. Like they were totally different beings. And so the church was gathering saying, it feels like it's pretty essential to know, is Jesus God or is he just another man? And this may be an idea that you hear and you go, yeah, that's old school. Like I don't know anybody who's teaching things like that these days. And as two pit stops, I would just love to share with you, there's actually two churches in town. And two churches in a lot of towns who have a pretty similar view of Jesus as Arius did. And I think as I want to set up for us, like when we say Jesus here, what do we mean? It's one thing to just say that and define that. It is so helpful to just have some different ideas to contrast it with. And so we're going to actually take a look at three different worldviews of Jesus this morning, two from churches, one from not a church, and then we're going to spend some time digging into Scripture and going, what do we believe about this Jesus? But one group that's kind of Arius adjacent would be a group of people called Jehovah's Witnesses. And if you spent any time digging into Jehovah's Witness theology, there's a lot in there that I would say those essentials are different than the essentials that you just heard in this Nicene Creed. For example, they would say, well, Jesus wasn't God. He was like God, though. Sounds very much like Arius. Jesus was the firstborn spirit child of God. He was a totally new kind of human, but once upon a time there was God, and then later in a timeline, then there was Jesus. But they are not the same thing. One came from the other at a later point. He's a great example. You should absolutely follow him. In fact, the better you follow him, the better your chances are of making it to heaven. But this Jesus character, if you're a Jehovah's Witness, when he died, it was his body that was killed, no question about that. And he was absolutely resurrected, but what was resurrected was not his body. What was resurrected was his spirit. And so Jesus, once again, as he started, is back to being a spirit child, this child of God's, but not in a physical body. This body, then, that you experience and that I experience, this physical earth, if you're a Jehovah's Witness, this is a place that is kind of like a shell. Like we're trying to just get out of this place. Like you could almost explain this as like the house is on fire and the goal is to get out before it all burns down. Even so, he's not God. In heaven, if and when we get there, he's another citizen of heaven. God is still not the same. In fact, God is actually a little bit far away. You really can't relate fully to him, but this Jesus, the party that this Jesus is inviting us to, is a party that says, I'm close to him, I'm like a kid, but I'm not with him. I'm just nearby. That's a significant distinction when you're asked the question, who do you say that Jesus is? Is he fully God, or is he just a really good man? Or is he like a spirit child? The best invitation that this Jesus can give you if you're a Jehovah's Witness is an ejection seat button from this life. Punch it. This world is to be escaped. You and your body, your suffering, you won't be remade perfectly here. You'll just be leaving this behind. We're throwing everything here away. It's a worldview of Jesus. There's another group of people, another church here in town that has a kind of similar but a little bit different view, and this would be the Church of the Latter-day Saints or the Mormon Church. And their view of Jesus is really distinct even from the Jehovah's Witnesses. They would say this: Jesus for sure was not like the same as God, but once upon a time, God the Father and once upon a time, God the Mother got together and had a baby, and his name is Jesus. Now, God the Father had this day as he was looking out at humanity and seeing all the jacked up things that we do to each other and to ourselves. And he was like, hey, we need to redeem this whole situation. So I'm taking ideas from the crowd. We're just polling the room. What should we do about this? And one of his children, who goes by the name of Lucifer or Satan, said, well, I've got an idea. I think what we should do is we should just program humans to be obligated to choose to do the right thing all the time. God was like, interesting idea. Anybody else have a proposal? And one of God's other kids named Jesus said, well, I've got an idea. I think that free will is really important. I think humans should have the ability to choose who they follow. But obviously, if they're going to have that choice, they're going to need a good example so they know what they're choosing between. So I'll volunteer to go down and be this perfect man, and that way they can have my example to follow, and then they can choose what they want to do. God the Father says, interesting, between these two choices, I like Jesus's best. You're promoted. Lucifer, just hang out where you're at. Lucifer gets pissed. And they go to war. And there's this celestial war, and Jesus and his brother Lucifer fight. Jesus wins. And then the story that we get of Jesus is of this man who comes down, who leads this really idyllic life, and who's giving us an idea of, here's how you're supposed to do it. Now do it in kind. You have the ability to choose how you act. And in some ways, this is very much simplifying this idea, this view, this worldview of Jesus. But for Mormons, there's different layers of heaven. The best layer that you can get to is a layer that you get to by making sure that you were baptized in a particular way, that you were married in a particular place, that your finances do exactly some particular things. And if you can do those things, now you've achieved heaven. So if this is the real Jesus, I would just encourage us, the best party that he can invite us to is another one where you can get close to God, but you can't necessarily be with him. And with this Jesus, you have to earn the invitation. You got to make sure that you're doing the right things, because if you're not acting the right way, you actually can't come anymore. So make sure that you're marching in line. Now, I'm moving quickly through these, just because these are real day. This is how some people view Jesus. And I think that's really important. And I want to do honor and respect to making sure that this is real. Who do you say Jesus is? And with any of these ideas so far, would you say I agree or disagree? And if you disagree, why? Because if your answer is, well, that's just not what I've been taught, well, then what have you been taught? Who is Jesus to you? I don't know that there's many of us here who are like, oh yeah, like for the next 3 months, I'm actually touring between this church and a Jehovah's Witness church and a Latter-day Saints church and just trying to see, like, I'm so glad that we're doing this. Most of us are like, yeah, that's not an interest, but there is a view, a worldview of Jesus that I think most of us swim in every day. And I think in an American culture that maybe has some roots near evangelicalism, there's a sense of God and Jesus out there, but what does it actually look like? And I think it's not uncommon at all, even for folks in this room, this may be your worldview of Jesus, to have a view of him where you say, Jesus was a good teacher. He's a really good prophet, but I get a little bit hung up on things like he's walking on water. I'm like, Dad, I just can't buy that. Or that he raised a dead girl from the dead and back to life. That he took somebody's Lunchable and fed a crowd of 5,000 people. That's just unreasonable. I think that Jesus is a lot more like a Gandhi type of a figure, that he just did a lot of good for the world, that he had really good ideas. I have no problem believing that he was crucified. That seems like there's historical reason for that. But the fact that he was resurrected, I mean, it's a bit much. And I think that this is actually a reasonable response, that we would call this naturalism or humanism or secularism. Really, this boils down to a worldview of Jesus that says all we have is science. And if it can't be replicated in a lab, I can't buy it. This is a worldview, and you may have heard it like this before, that says spirituality is just a fairy tale that humanity tells itself because it needs a crutch for how jacked up things are. The sun is not a god. It's a ball of fire. Healing is done via medicine, and we'll eventually be able to cure most things. We just need more time to research. And if you go full send on a worldview of Jesus like this, we think that the brokenness that we see in the world is just a lack of either information or resources. And that if we could just teach people the right things, and if we could just give them what they need, programs and food and education, the bad choices will just leave. And as a kid who grew up in the era of DARE, like the drug, anti-drug program, I would say my fifth grade class, we all sat through the same information. We were all told not to do drugs. And the reception rate of that was not 100%, as it turns out, in the long run. There are a lot of programs out there who are like, hey, we have these countries or these communities where food is just such a major obstacle. And as we look at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, if we could just solve the food crisis, we could really see these communities turn around. And there is no doubt that having resources like that help a lot. But when it comes to fixing a community, I think when we look at how much more education can we shove into this hoping that it's going to fix it? How much more food can we shove into this hoping that it's going to fix it? At the end of the day, DARE, these programs, there's still crime. There's still people that are making choices that they've been told not to make, and they're doing it anyway. One thing that's so hard about this worldview is, sure, choice matters. But it just can't account for evil in the world. It can't account for whole systems where it just seems like there's something insidious that's continuing to make evil a default position that we're falling back into. There's a nagging problem when we're trying to fix the world with our own solutions. We just can't do it. This was at the root of the downfall of folks like Marx and communism. We can't fix it on our own, no matter how level we try to make the playing field. The other issue, if this is our worldview, is that we run into this God who's nowhere to be found, actually. I mean, if he's the creator of everything, but he's not involved in our world, this view just leaves you in a place of like, yeah, God just doesn't care. Like, he's totally removed. He's not active. And there's actually an additional issue, if we're looking at Jesus this way. A pastor priest, T.F. Torrance, discusses the terrible implications of denying the full deity of Jesus. And he says this, if the deity of Christ is denied, then the cross becomes a terrible monstrosity. If Jesus Christ is man only and not also God, then we lose faith in God. Because how could we believe in a God who allows the best man that ever lived to be put to death on a cross? If you put Jesus Christ as a mere man on the cross and put God in heaven like some distant God imprisoned in his own lonely abstract deity, such a God is monstrously unconcerned with our life as he does not lift a finger to help Jesus. So you can have this view of like, he was just a good teacher. But if you deny that, any version then of God that you have is a monstrous God. And so I think if this is our worldview of Jesus and how we look at him, the party that this version of Jesus invites us to is actually, it looks a lot like the world that we're living in right now. The best he can get you is actually this. It's a world that periodically has people with really good ideas and programs, but otherwise a world that it can't fully execute those ideas. And it remains in decay. And it leaves people wondering where the heck God is, if he's even real. And I think for me, I mean, when I look at like Jehovah's Witnesses and Mormons and then this worldview of like he's a good teacher, I think this is the one as for myself and I think for our church, because I think this is such a typical way of viewing Jesus that I would say this is the one that I think we should be most concerned with. There's a popular phrase that's been tossed around in Christian literature for a long time, and it's the concept of a Christian atheist. Somebody's like, yeah, Jesus, totally great with that. I hit agree on the iPhone thing. But God actually doesn't have much to do with me, and vice versa. Like the God that I follow, he just like doesn't seem like he cares that much about me. I don't really care to talk with him all that much. I kind of just live my life pretty well removed from him, regardless of where he is with me. And I think most of that thinking comes from an approach to scripture and approach to our answer of Jesus from a person who's saying, hey, he's a really good teacher. Like Jesus, I like that guy. But if he's God, and if God is good, man, it just seems like he's involved. It seems like he's a creator who made something and he really cares about it. Like he's willing to ante up if something goes wrong. And now as we look at this fourth idea of when we talk about Jesus, what do we mean? What's essential to believe about him? Is it essential to believe that he's God? I think we're going to find that that's true. Is it essential to believe that he was a human being with flesh and bone? I think that's true. I don't know how many of you are like super into March Madness. We're huge college basketball fans in our house. We're massive KU Jayhawks fans. For those of you that are chuckling under your breath right now, yes, I know they lost in the first round. Thank you so much. Salt in the wound. When we're trying to answer the question, who is Jesus to me? It is a super messed up thing. It would be horrible teaching for me to be like, pick your favorite. Pick the one that like stands out the best. Because my favorite is the KU Jayhawks. They are not going to make it to the championship. It does not matter what your favorite is. What matters is what's true. So when you're asked the question, who do you say that Jesus is? It is fundamental that your answer is not based off of preference or ignorance, but is based off of knowing something that is true about him. And so we're back into our scripture for the day. John 1:1 is one of like so many places that we could have jumped in for today. If you're like, I'm looking for some Devo work to do later this week, read anything between John 15 and 17. And it just puts such a relational spin on all the content we're about to read. John is a poet. I mean, a master poet as he's writing the introduction to his book. But hearing all these different views of Jesus, who is he, what's he like, what can he actually invite me to because he belongs there, because that's who he is. I want you to hear it from John again, and I'm just going to pause and point out just some observations of what we read when we read John like this. This is what it's saying about Jesus, John 1:1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. So pause right there. So there's seemingly two. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God. Okay? We got that so far. And the Word was God. Oh, okay. Wait. So we don't have two gods. We don't have a Word and a God. They were both there in the very beginning of all things, but they're the same thing. So they're distinct, but similar. And it's really important that they're timeless. In the beginning. Like at the start of the story, chapter one, actually there were two characters minimum who were already. He, starting in verse 2, he, okay, so this word that we're talking about, he, this is not just a concept. He, the Word, is a person. He's a male person. It seems important that he has flesh and bone and is engendered. He was in the beginning with God. Holy smokes. Okay, so not just a concept, like this idea of God just kind of explodes off the page if we're looking at it this way. Because if the Word was in the beginning with God, and God, like God and the Word, like it's all kind of this thing. But if he's in the beginning with God, if there's like a human, an engendered human being, that's phenomenal. He was there before all time began. Verse 3, all things came into being through him, and without him not one thing came into being. Okay, so this person who is God and was with God in the beginning was there pre-creation, and therefore he's eternal, but also he wasn't just present for creation, he was active in creating all things. I don't know when the last time you made something was. Every time I get to make something in my shop, I'm so emotionally tied to that. I love making stuff. I particularly love making stuff that I get to give away because it's got my heart all built into that sucker. The fact that this word, who's also a man, who's also God, who's also eternal, was involved in the creating of a thing, I just know as somebody who creates, when you create, you're in love. What has come into being, verse 4, in him was life, and the life was the light of all people. Okay, so this word man, God, eternal, creator, is the essence of life and light. He's not just spinning up new ideas and like chucking them into creation, like here's another one for planet Earth. He's installing himself as the guiding light of these things. He is life itself. And John's now setting up this metaphor of light and dark. The light shines in the darkness. The darkness did not overcome it. I love that as John's talking about Jesus, he doesn't explain away evil and suffering in the world, but that it's there. To all who received him, who believed in his name, he gave the power to become children of God. So he's restoring us to relationship with God. We who are born, not of blood or of the will of the flesh or of the will of man, but of God. So there's a whole new birth that he's talking about here. My oldest descendant that I can track my DNA back to is now no longer Adam. But for those who choose to believe, I am reborn with kind of a new set of DNA. My oldest living relative is this eternal God. I now belong to him. Jesus is this missing link that is connecting me, restoring me back to my heavenly Father. This word became flesh, and it lived among us. We've seen his glory, the glory of a Father's only Son, full of grace and truth. This is still God's only Son, his only begotten Son. Just because we're children now too, like we're restored to our Father, it doesn't make us equals with him. We're not begotten of God, but we are children, and we see both truth and grace when we look at this God. Okay, so a lot to digest in just a few verses from early John. I think if we can break that down just a little bit more, here's just a couple fundamental things, and then we'll begin landing the plane. This Jesus, it was so wild, you guys. First service, we had to shut down the basement, so we had like every kid up here. Trying to explain the dual nature of Jesus to a 5-year-old and a 95-year-old at the same time, that was hard. I'm like singed at the edges right now. I'm so glad for second service. Whew, fully God. This Jesus, this word, this man who is always, was begotten of God. Okay, now this is a bit of a mind bender for me still, and I think I'm fine leaving some mystery involved here. But to be beget from something, my dad and mom begot me. I am made from them. I have the essence of them. I carry on that DNA. And for us as human beings, we totally get this. Like, yeah, people make babies, and then those babies get with more people, and they make more babies, and beget, beget, beget. The thing that's really weird about this Jesus and the way that it set it up is he was in the beginning, before there was time, and he was begotten. When we think about having children, we're very time-keyed. There's an order to how that's supposed to work. This Jesus is begotten. He is of the essence of the Father, as you would look at as a son who came from a dad. They carry the same essence. But the major difference here is in the beginning, this had already happened. And it's not like, well, there was time before time. So on some other timeline, that's when it happened. And there was once a time where God was, and then Jesus wasn't, and then Jesus came to be. According to John, and it's so important when we talk about why, what do we mean when we say Jesus? There was never a time where there was God and not Jesus. God the Father and God the Son have always been, and one carries the essence of the other. They are distinct, but they're also out of time. If you're like me and you're like, I'm good with some mystery being there, we can leave it there. That's how that works. As the story goes, God created humankind to be good, but we chose sin. And any sin we commit is fundamentally a sin that's committed against God. Therefore, only God can say, I forgive you. This was a fun story to tell with five-year-olds in the room. If I punch my brother in the face and then turn to my sister and say, will you forgive me? She's for sure popping a bowl of popcorn, like, for sure, I forgive you. Do it again. I'll forgive you a second time. You can only forgive the person who's done the wrong to you. Like, that's the exchange that happens. If sin is real, then the only person who can forgive is God. He can't just create some other person and be like, okay, there, now you can forgive them for the things done wrong to me. Only God can forgive the things that we've done wrong to him. So it's incredibly important that Jesus is God. Because otherwise, if he's forgiving us, it actually doesn't count. The wrong has not been set right. We're not capable of fixing it on our own either. This Jesus, this Word, this Son, he put on flesh and bone. And so while he is not, he is never made, he was born later of a woman. Her name's Mary. He was always before Mary, but there was a moment where moving forward, the man Jesus was born. Both of these things exist in this person of Christ. But this Jesus, if he's God, is both the wronged party and the one who's coming to set things right for the sins committed. If I have a plate, say it's my parents' plate, and I break it on the ground, they can for sure say that I am forgiven. But the problem is we still have a broken plate. God loves justice. And for God, the way he made things is the way he intends them to be. So if there's a broken plate between me and God, part of what forgiveness looks like is we need a full plate back. And Zach, you can sit on the ground and get as much super glue all over your fingertips as you want to try and do. You're never going to get that thing back to perfect. I need a perfect plate because that's what got broken. And this fully God Jesus walks into the room and he says, I'm a perfect plate. For all the things you've broken and shattered up in your life, you can have mine. And if God requires this back, offer this to him. That's how that works. And only a perfect God can do that. And this is where we border on this perfect man. He's never not been, but he was born. Why must he be God for all this to work? I mean, one thing I love about Jesus, and particularly his humanity, this is a Jesus who eats and he suffers. He gets me. He doesn't have to leave his body behind. When he comes back to life from the dead, he is still body and spirit. For those that were here at the beginning of the year as we were talking about heaven, the way that the Christian worldview works is not, well, we're kind of spirit and we're kind of body, and someday we escape our body and we go to heaven. That's not Jesus' story. Jesus is a spirit that remains in his body. Heaven is a physical and a spiritual place that are intended to be together, not one escaping the other. If he's fully God, then this God eats and cries and laughs. He's human. He's me. And heaven, therefore, is governed by an entity that is like me. He gets me. He understands what it means to be a human. It completely cuts away the power of the relational dynamic that leaves me separated from God. Because now, because a man is God, God totally understands me. And actually, there's now a way for me to have an actual relationship with God. It's not like a Mormon or a Jehovah's Witness idea of someday you go to heaven, but God's actually still somewhere totally else. He's removed. He's different. In this worldview, God is knowable. So, this Jesus, when we read John, what's the party that he can invite us to? The best he can do is to offer you a rebirth. Your oldest ancestor is not Adam. It is relationship with God the Father. The most primal and fundamental thing about you is not your time-sensitive DNA slowly ticking off days till you die, but a new life that ultimately begins with him in his perfect DNA, which means that I'm in his family, and that while I'm not an equal with God, I am fully known and can fully know him. And it's important to treat this with this idea of what's true. And at the end of the day, I mean, really what comes down to is, are we choosing the Jayhawks to win the championship? Or do we know that there's something true? And it raises a whole other issue that we'll get to on another week of, can we trust the Bible? Is what's written here, is it worth standing on? One other thing I want to be clear on is, do you have to be like certain about what you believe about Jesus when you're asked? Do you have to like nail it to the wall and have the Nicene Creed memorized, blah, 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 or John 1:1 memorized? I don't think so. At the end of the day, it seems to me what's essential to know about Jesus as your beginning is that I have a need. I'm not okay. And that I want to look fully in the face of the real Jesus. It doesn't matter who we're it does matter who we're talking about. But having everything figured out, I don't think is a prerequisite to grabbing hold of him. Okay, it's a lot of like theory and idea and theology. Where does this actually matter? And I would say for today, it matters in three places. One, Jesus is not about you proving that you're good enough. Thank goodness. I know I'm not nailing this. And I can stop trying to earn my way to heaven and perfection and just say I'm saved by grace alone. I'm saved because Jesus just waltzed in the room and handed me a fresh plate and said, you can turn this in. This Jesus forgives because Jesus is God and he can. He has authority and understanding. He looks at you and me and he says, it doesn't matter what you've done or what's been done to you. I'm offering all of me. And he can forgive. No one is too far gone for him. No one is beyond our prayer and his power. Second thing, I can know God if this is true, and God can know me, not someday, but now. Being in a broken world and a broken body, it just doesn't preclude you from knowing him. Sure, there is a new body and a new world that is coming someday. You'll know him more fully, but Jesus makes it so clear. You can experience God right now, today. The point of my life, then, is to begin knowing God better today than yesterday. There's no wrong thing or broken thing that will be left the way that it is, because this God cares about this world, cares about interacting with me now. He's already in the process of reforming it all. This is not a fire to be run away from or a place to be escaped, but a place that will be lovingly remade. And third, suffering and justice, they just matter to this God. And therefore, they should matter to me. This Jesus of John 1, he is body and flesh and bone. He is among us. What happens in these bodies and this earth, it just seems like it matters to him. There are so many ways that you can look at Jesus and say, Jesus is just the first person running away from this dumpster fire of a world. But when you read this text, it seems to reverse the story and say, Jesus is the first running into it to say, I'm not yet done saving this thing. It's not too far gone. What happens in these bodies matter. Therefore, we can seek justice in these bodies. We can seek justice for our physical world and seek goodness now, or as Jesus would say, the kingdom of heaven is among you. It's not just on a shelf waiting for a later point in time. It's now. Our true enemies, then, are never people, but spiritual forces at work in the world. Something we have limited power to overcome, but something Jesus has every power to overcome. Why does this matter? Because however you're suffering in the world right now, it's not something you've got to do alone. And it's not something that there's just like powerlessness and I either shrug my shoulders or try and slug it out as best I can. If this version of Jesus is the true version, the places where I suffer in the world, whether personally or on behalf of others, immediately then become places that I return to Jesus and say, help. And not just a help of resignment, but a help of how do I join you in what you're trying to set right in the world. That's why this view of Jesus matters so much. Darkness has never overcome him in any way. So whatever you're facing, whatever wrong is in the world, Jesus won't just bring goodness someday. He's already bringing it. He is goodness and will bring goodness. He is the place that I look for when I'm suffering and in need of justice, and he offers it now, even if the world is offering something else. As we finish this teaching today, I just would love to offer us a contemplative moment. This view of Jesus offers plenty of things for us to consider. Questions like, where am I feeling hopelessness or despair right now? Where am I in need of forgiveness? Where am I needing Jesus to draw close? Where am I needing understanding from him, even friendship? Or just, where am I needing direction? We're going to get ready to receive communion together in just a moment, and this will be up on the screen. So as you hold these elements, and as you think through these questions, I would just love you to consider, where are you inviting Jesus in, and what is he offering you? For those who are passing communion today, I'd invite you to begin passing. For those that are new to Discovery, we'd invite you to take part in this. We just would ask that you understand what this means and have an appreciation that these elements are a representation of the body and blood of Christ moving towards you for your healing. These are gluten-free. For the folks upstairs, if you can make sure somebody's grabbing it on the side, hold these elements and consider these questions. And I'll come back, we'll receive these elements together, and we'll pray.